Sometimes the greatest wisdom comes in the words of children. When I was a young child, my favorite book was Dr. Seuss's Horton Hears a Who. Now, it's a powerful story of a loving elephant who discovers that there is a whole world of who's living on a speck of dust that happens to be resting on top of a clover. Fearing for their lives, he rescues them before the clover falls into a jungle pool, saying this: "Some poor little person who's shaking with fear that he'll blow in the pool, he has no way to steer. I'll just have to save him because, after all, a person's a person, no matter how small." Well, the problem is, all the other jungle residents are skeptical of the who's because they don't have the giant ears of the elephant to hear them. So, led by a proud kangaroo and her baby kangaroo in her pouch, they set out to destroy this little dust speck world, believing that Horton has gone crazy. Well, sometimes the most intelligent teachings can be found in the simplest of sayings, whether it's a person's a person, no matter how small, or as in the words of the sixth commandment, you shall not murder. Now, the principle underlying this commandment is the same one stated in those simple childlike words of Dr. Seuss, that all human life is precious and to be valued greatly. Now, this is a principle that's universally recognized and acknowledged. Every culture, every country has laws against the malicious taking of human life. Unfortunately, even though we do not condone murder, we cheapen life in many different ways. And despite all of our claims to enlightenment and progress, we are so often like the self-sophisticated kangaroos in Horton Hears a Who. We think we're smarter. We think we know better. And we end up endangering life. And the results are in when it comes to modern society. And the statistics tell a frightening tale. Right? The last century is the most murderous century on record. And now here we are 21 years into the next century, and though we have yet to fight any world wars, it is still way too early to see if we've truly learned any lessons. But if you just followed the headlines, you know, the news that has made the headlines throughout our century so far, you could still see that we're dealing with this problem. I mean, weapons of mass destruction, war, terrorism, ethnic cleansing, right? Abortion, capital punishment, infanticide, euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide, children locked in cages, police brutality, violent riots, right? That's just 21 years of headlines. Now, all of these issues, as diverse as they are, all have at their heart the very same question. What is the value and the worth of a human life? And how we answer this question is of utmost importance because it will determine how we answer so many other questions. And the problem is that modern society is really unable to answer this question with clear conviction, or if it does, it lacks a solid foundation. Now, scripture is not unique in affirming the dignity and worth of human life. What sets the Bible apart is that it gives a solid foundation for that claim, and it gives a richness and a depth to this truth. Now, in the original Hebrew, the sixth commandment contains only two words, which translated is no murder. No murder. Right? Just two words, very clear, very concise. Now, what's interesting is that Hebrew has seven different words for killing, you know, and each one has kind of a different nuance to it.
This particular word, used 47 times in the Old Testament, signifies premeditated murder, right? It is the malicious, deliberate taking of a human life. Now, unfortunately, these very clear waters got muddied in 1611 when the King James Version translated this verse as "thou shalt not kill." Oh, that they had translated it properly, "thou shalt not murder." And this mistranslation has led to a lot of confusion and misunderstanding and seeing this commandment prohibiting all sorts of things that were never really included in the original commandment. Now, how can I say that? Well, because of the law itself. There are other places in the law or other places in scripture that show this isn't so. Right? For instance, we know from Genesis chapter 9, verses 2 and 3, that the sixth commandment does not include the killing of animals, all right, for food, for clothing, that sort of thing. Here's what God tells us in those verses. All the wild animals, large and small, all the birds and fish will be afraid of you. I have placed them in your power. In other words, God delegates his authority to us to have authority over the animals. And then God says, I have given them to you for food, just as I have given you grain and vegetables. We also know from Exodus 22, verse 2, that the sixth commandment does not include what we would call self-defense or the defense of private property, all right? The Old Testament law had sort of its own castle doctrine. Here's what God sets forth in the law. He says, if a thief is caught breaking in and is struck so that he dies, the defender is not guilty of bloodshed, all right? So you kill somebody breaking into your property, you're not guilty of violating the sixth commandment, all right? It also does not include manslaughter, the accidental taking of a human life. First of all, it's an accident. It isn't deliberate. It isn't malicious. The Old Testament provided for six cities of refuge. Right? Now, these were cities that were strategically placed throughout the country so that no matter where you were in the Promised Land, you were within one day's journey of getting to one of these cities of refuge. So if you accidentally killed someone, you could flee to a city of refuge and find protection and refuge there so that you couldn't be killed for revenge or retribution. We find these cities in Deuteronomy 19, and it even gives an example of what this would include. A guy goes into the woods to cut wood, and as he's chopping wood, the axe head flies off the handle, hits a neighbor, and kills him. That man's allowed to flee to one of the cities of refuge where he is protected from the neighbor's family so they can't take revenge on him. All right. Now, there was a penalty, a fine to be paid for accidentally taking someone's life, but it wasn't considered a violation of the sixth commandment. We also know that the sixth commandment does not include capital punishment. In fact, scripture even commands it. In Genesis 9:6, it says, any person who murders must be killed. You must execute anyone who murders another person, for to kill a person is to kill a living being made in God's image. You hear that? Capital punishment, far from taking away from the value of human life, was meant to protect it. Right. It was to say that human life is so valuable, so sacred, so worthwhile that anyone who takes it forfeits their own. The Old Testament law also permitted warfare under certain circumstances. In fact, not only did God allow it under certain circumstances, he expected and even commanded it in certain circumstances. For instance, he commanded the Israelites to go to war for just and righteous causes. Now, we might say, whoa, time out, wait a minute, that's different. You know, God had a special relationship with Israel. He authorized to do things on his behalf That's not true of any other nation. And that's certainly true. But it is interesting because the Old Testament prophets contain condemnations, not for Israel, but against Israel's neighboring countries, for not defending the defenseless and helping their neighbors stand up to invading armies. So there was this expectation that you will come to a neighbor's aid when they are being unjustly attacked. And so Christianity, from its earliest days, has long understood that warfare is sometimes a necessary reality or a necessary evil in an evil and sinful world. And early on in the church, Christian leaders developed what is called just war theory. And it had several guidelines. They were, you must have a just cause. You must have a just intention. War must be a last resort. You got to pursue all other means to solve a problem first. Right? There must be a formal declaration. There must be limited objectives. All right. You're not going to just conquer everything, but you're going to achieve only the righteous ends that you have set out. You must have proportionate means, all right? So you're not looking to just completely wipe out a nation. You know, don't use a nuclear bomb when a small force will do, that kind of idea. And then the seventh standard was non-combatant immunity. You don't go around purposely targeting civilians. Now, this just war idea has been kind of amended and adjusted in different ways, but those were the understood parameters. But whatever the case, the New Testament makes it very clear that human governments have a delegated authority from God. They have been instituted by God and thus authorized to take life in pursuit and in defense of justice. Paul writes in Romans 13, 1 through 5, let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which has been established by God. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, whoever rebels against the authority is rebelling against that which God has instituted. And those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. Now, this is judgment that comes not from God, but from the governing authorities. For rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free of the one in authority? Then do what is right, and you will be commended. For the one in authority is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for rulers do not bear the sword for no reason. They are God's servant, agents of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. So God has authorized civil authorities to, quote unquote, bear the sword. The Apostle Peter writes in 1 Peter 2:13 and 14, for the Lord's sake, accept all authority. The king is the head of state, and the officials he has appointed, for the king has sent them to punish all who do wrong and to honor those who do right. So these passages make it clear that the civil authorities have a delegated authority from God to wield the power of life and death in pursuit of and in defense of justice. Now, when the state wields the power of that sword for other reasons, but not in pursuit or defense of justice, then they are guilty, right? Then they follow under God's condemnation, and they'll have to answer to him, if not their own citizens, right? So that kind of gives us an idea of what's included and what's not included in the sixth commandment. But if we stop there, we have completely missed the heart of this commandment, right? Because knowing this principle is more than just, you know, following some sort of list. We need to appreciate and understand just how special life is to God and to treasure life ourselves. And God's word gives us two basic reasons why we are to revere human life. And the first is because God is sovereign. Right? God is the ruler of the universe, the ruler of life. He's the creator of life. And so ultimately, he decides when life is given and when it is to be taken. Ezekiel 18:4 says, "For every living soul belongs to me, the Father as well as the Son, both alike belong to me." That's what God says. So only God has the right to decide who lives and who dies. He's the author of life. He's the creator of life. And the sixth commandment stakes God's claim over all of life. All of life belongs to God and God alone, except in those cases that he has delegated to man. We have no right to take that upon ourselves. So murder, understood in its fullest sense, isn't just a crime against fellow people, but it's a crime against God. So number one, the sovereignty of God. But we must also value human life because human life is sacred, right? The sanctity of human life. This is what that means, that it's sacred, it's holy, it is set apart. And human life is special in ways that are unique from all other life, right? All living things were created by God, but people are truly a special creation. After every day of creation, God looked at what he made and he said, "It is good." But after he created Adam and Eve and placed them in the garden, he looks and he says, "It is very good." Right? Something special was happening here. And we see that in how Adam and Eve were created, all right? Humanity was created uniquely from all other living things. Every other creature, God simply said, "Let it be," and there it was. He spoke it into being. But Adam, he forms out of the dust of the ground, and he gets his life from the very breath of God. God breathes his life into him. Eve, likewise, was created uniquely, taken from Adam, right? And together, they are said to have been created in the image of God. And this is an attribute that is applied to all of humanity. We are uniquely created in the image of God, uniquely set apart from all creation. Psalm 139 says that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. Bruce Larson has written, "Human life is precious to God. Each human life is valued by him and should be valued by us because life is his decision, his creation, his gift. Each one of us contains his fingerprint." Each one of us is a one-of-a-kind work of art. You are a divine work of art. Right? You are a Rembrandt, except in your case, the artist is God himself. And each one of us, no matter how productive or how intelligent or how much money we make or how beautiful in the eyes of others or how valued by society, each person has been invested with immense value and worth by God himself. You cannot place a price tag on an individual's value. You are not what you own, right? You're not what you do for a living. You are not what other people think of you. You are a special creation of God. And so is every person that you will ever meet. So when we start considering the sixth commandment for our lives as Christians and as we follow Jesus today, what does this really mean for us? Well, on the one hand, it's very likely that no one watching me right now is guilty of murder, right? You haven't shot anyone. I haven't strangled anyone. But does that mean we can just kind of say, got this one all covered, all good, next? No. Because we must go deeper. We must get to the heart of this commandment. And Jesus does that, does this in Matthew 5, and the heart of this commandment is, well, the heart. Here's what Jesus says. "You have heard that it was said to the people long ago," and he quotes the sixth commandment, "Do not murder. And anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you, right? Jesus is deepening this, right? He's stretching it. He says, but I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. The word that he uses for anger here contains the idea of malice, hatred. You see, according to Jesus, murder is much more than just the pulling of a trigger or the thrusting of a blade, right? It begins in the heart. It begins with the bitterness, the malice, the anger, the hatred, the lack of love that we harbor in our hearts. Pastor Rick Atchley writes, I do not have to physically end your life to harbor in my heart the attitudes that foster all the killings that go on in the world. Now, maybe we desire changes in our justice system. Maybe we think there needs to be some changes in the laws. But Jesus says we have to begin with our own hearts. And the biggest mistake that we can make with this commandment is to believe that we have kept it simply because we haven't committed the physical act, right? Yet all the while, we harbor these thoughts and feelings of bitterness, hatred, and contempt for others. So how many friendships have been torn apart? How many churches have been split because we have murder in our hearts? We murder with our words. We slay with our silence. We strangle with our neglect. And it's time that we let Jesus deal with the murder here, right? It is deadly. Paul warns in Ephesians 4, 26 and 27 says, do not let the sun go down on you while you are still angry. And he gives a reason. Do not give the devil a foothold. Right? Anger in our hearts opens us. It exposes us. It allows the devil to get a wedge in there. Right? And some of you have been carrying around murder in your hearts for years. Right? And now, right, the devil has a beachhead firmly established in your life. And it's time to let Jesus take that. Now, the act of murder, it takes a life in one quick, horrible moment. But hatred, it takes a life one small piece by one small piece over a long period of time. Sadly, there's a lot of this in the church. In the 19th century, there was a famous feud between two well-known preachers. One of them was the Reverend Newman Smith and another famous preacher, Robert Hall. And Smith was mad at Hall over some religious point. And so Smith wrote a bitter pamphlet denouncing Hall and his dangerous doctrine. But he couldn't think of a good title. And so he sent the pamphlet to a friend to have him suggest a good title for his angry pamphlet. Well, years before, Newman Smith had written a very popular, widely read pamphlet called Come to Jesus. And so when his friend finished reading his biting words against Hall, he returns the pamphlet with this note. The title which I suggest for your pamphlet is this, Go to Hell by the author of Come to Jesus. And it's such a perfect picture. So many times we're talking out of both sides of our mouth. We're talking about the love of Jesus and the salvation and forgiveness and mercy and grace. And yet so often there are words and actions of anger and bitterness and resentment, murder in our hearts coming out of the other side of our mouth. We must treasure and revere life wherever, whenever, however we can, right? Instead of allowing it to be taken piece by little piece, let us find ways to build it up, even if it's piece by little piece. Because if we don't value and protect life, even in the small ways, we're going to lose it in much bigger ways. Nazi Germany provides, I think, the perfect example of this. As we look back, we're horrified by the horrendous evil and the atrocities that were committed in the Holocaust. We're dumbfounded that such things could ever happen, especially how did normal people ever go along for this? But for those who lived through it, it was a very subtle process that happened, right, one step at a time. Dr. Leo Alexander worked with the American Council at the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials, and here's what he had to say. Whatever proportion these crimes finally assumed, it became evident to all who investigated them that they had started from very small beginnings. The beginnings at first were merely a subtle shift in the basic attitudes of physicians. It started with the acceptance of the attitude basic in the euthanasia movement, that there is such a thing as a life not worthy to be lived. Now, this attitude in its early stages concerned itself merely with the severely and chronically sick. Gradually, the sphere of those to be included in this category was enlarged to encompass the socially unproductive, the ideologically unwanted, the racially unwanted, and finally, all non-Germans. But it is important to realize that the infinitely small wedged in lever from which the entire trend of mind received its impetus was the attitude towards the non-rehabilitable sick. Now, as frightening as those words are, consider the words of one who experienced this slow descent into the abyss in firsthand. Martin Niemöller was a German minister who pastored a German church in the 1930s, and eventually he became one of Hitler's millions of victims, arrested and tortured in one of the concentration camps. And here's what he says. In Germany, they first came for the communists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Catholics, and I didn't speak up because I was a Protestant. And then they came for me, and by that time, there was no one left to speak up. Let me be very honest with you. Right? Any nation, any group of people is capable of those sorts of atrocities, right? Especially when Christ is not the cornerstone of culture. And the downward slide is well begun in our country. The only thing standing between where we are and where Nazi Germany ended up are faithful Christians who truly value life and hold it to be sacred. And we love life because we worship the creator of life. We honor life because our lives have been saved. We revere life because we have been given life to its fullest. And a world that is slipping and stumbling and falling towards death must be able to see in us a life that is life indeed. We must reverse this slow slide, and we can do it through small things. Proverbs 24, 11 and 12 tells us, rescue those being led away to slaughter. Isaiah 58, 7 says that we are to share food with the hungry. Matthew 25 tells us to look after the least of our fellow man, the starving, the naked, the lonely, the sick, the imprisoned. Acts 20, 35 says that we are to help the weak. Hebrews 13:3 says, remember those in prison. James 1:27 says that religion that God our Father considers pure and faultless is to look after widows and orphans. Right? And those are all ways that we can honor life. And this is how we keep the sixth commandment. It's more than just not taking life, not pulling the trigger. It's loving life honoring it, revering it, nurturing it. So find ways to build up life. Be creative in making the lives of others better. And anytime you come into contact with someone during the day, do a simple thing. Say a simple word that makes their lives even that much better, not the worse, for you having been a part of it. Find ways to make life richer, fuller. Right? And no one is better equipped to do this than us, right? Because we know him who is the way, the truth, and the life himself. We must lift our voices together, even in small ways, because the small things accomplish big things. Right? Just as it did in Horton, Here's a Who. Horton, in order to save the Who's, convinces them that they all have to yell as one to be heard. However, it isn't until the last littlest Who joined in with his teeny tiny yop that they were heard. Dr. Seuss writes, and that yop, that one small extra yop, put it over. Finally, at last, from that speck on that clover, their voices were heard. They rang out clear and clean, and the elephant smiled. Do you see what I mean? They've proved they are persons no matter how small, and their world was saved by the smallest of them all. How true, yes, how true, said the big kangaroo. And from now on, you know what I'm planning to do? From now on, I'm going to protect them with you. And the young kangaroo in her pouch said, me too. From the sun in the summer, from rain when it's fallish, I'm going to protect them no matter how smallish.